Genesis chapter 37. In the book of Genesis, there are 10 books of generations. There is the book of the generation of the heavens and the earth, the book of the generations of Adam, of Noah, of the sons of Noah, of Shem, of Terah, of Ishmael, of Isaac, of Esau, as in this chapter, chapter 36 that is, and Jacob in chapter 37. Now, chapter 36 lists the descendants of Esau. It begins with those words, "These are the generations of Esau, who is Edom." And that's a general heading for the whole of the chapter. And if you look at the chapter in that light, you will see that there is, in the first 8 verses, mention of Esau's wives. They are mentioned as Ada, Aholibama, and also Bashemath. And then from verse 9 to verse 14, and we must include verse 18, there is reference to his sons, Eliphaz, Reuel, Jeush, Joshem, and Korah. And then there is a reference to his grandsons in verses 11 and 12, and again in 15 and 16. The 7 sons of Eliphaz, found in those verses, and the 4 sons of Reuel in verses 13 and 17. So by the time we come to the 19th verse or so of this chapter 36, you will have covered Esau, his wives, his sons, and his grandsons. The rest of the chapter makes mention of the original occupiers of the land of Edom, which Esau possessed, in particular the sons of Seir and his 7 sons and daughters, and his 21 grandsons and granddaughter. And then there is mention of the kings of Edom in verses 31 to 39, and the 11 dukes of Edom, verses 40 to 43. So it gives us an account of Esau's family, and also an account of the place where they settled, and the inhabitants among whom they settled. Now, it's not my purpose, as you will have gathered from the reading, to expound this chapter tonight. But in passing, we may learn one or two truths. And first of all, as I look at chapter 36, I see the dangers of spiritual compromise. Esau compromised in the choice of his wives. He married among the people of the land, among the Canaanites. And there were some dreadful effects of those relationships, of those unions. And how careful we must be in our choice of friends, particularly our closest friends, that we choose according to the mind and will of God, for who knows where it will lead if we do not do so. The second thing I notice is that corruption runs in the blood. These descendants of Esau, his sons and his grandsons, there's not one good things said about any of them. Not one redeeming feature, apparently, about any of them. We're reminded of Matthew Henry's words, "Grace never runs in the blood, but corruption does." One thing is that corruption which passes naturally from one generation to another. And surely only sovereign grace can break the chain, and only sovereign grace can make a new beginning. The third thing I'd observe in this chapter is that there is no recognition in all of the names and the references in this chapter to God. Esau, who himself despised the birthright and the privileges and the relationship with God, not only produced a corrupt people, but a people without the knowledge of God. And we see this illustrated in our own day, where there is evident godlessness, and that godlessness is passed on. Not only is corruption passed on, but the lack of the knowledge of God is passed on. And what a dreadful thing for one generation to see the next generation rising like itself without the knowledge of God and without the experience of God. Fourth thing I notice from chapter 36 is that even such men prosper. It is evident from the reference not only to Esau's immediate family, but also to the occupants of the land, the Horites, that these men prospered. Some of them were heads of tribes, some of them were kings in their own right, in their own domains. Some were dukes or princes. We mustn't be surprised at that, because temporal blessings are common to all men. And we mustn't draw any false conclusion from that, for even the ungodly can appear to prosper in the things of this world. Fifth thing to observe is that it was revealed later in history that this seed of Esau was to be inveterate enemies to Israel. And it's not surprising, is it, when people have mixed up with heathens, when corruption goes on unabated, when there is no knowledge of God, when all they have is worldly good and no spiritual treasure, it's not surprising that such people not only have no time for God, but no time for his people. And Edom becomes almost symbolic in prophecy as a name for the terrible opponents of God's people, the attackers of the people of God. The sixth thing we observe is that the reference in chapter 36 is comparatively brief. Whole family of Esau is dealt with in just one chapter. After their generations, dealt with in just one chapter, or one part of a chapter. And why is that? Because the divine care and concern is not with the reprobate. The divine concern and care is with the elect people of God. And therefore the chapter summarily dismisses the descendants of Esau. God has no great interest in them. And yet lastly, I'll observe this from chapter 36, that there is a record of Esau, of his wives, of his children, and of his grandchildren. God knows their names. God knows what kind of people they were. what kind of privilege and opportunity they had. There's evidence of that in that we have this briefest record of them. God knows even their names, and their names have been written in his holy word. And it reminds us that God keeps a record of the wicked. It is not that he has a peculiar affection for them, but one day he will judge them according to the open books on the day of judgment. The books will be opened, and the dead shall be judged according to the things which are written in those books. And none will be able to plead that God doesn't know me, or God isn't aware of my circumstance, or God doesn't understand the experience through which I've passed. Just as here, there is evidence that God knew even the ungodly and could recall their names. So he knows the unbelievers and all the facts pertaining to them. And this will be used on a day of judgment. So we could look at chapter 36 and we could draw from it a number of lessons. But I intend to turn to chapter 37, which begins, "And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob." And whereas chapter 36 gives us the generations of Esau, the reprobate, here we have the generations of Jacob, the elect. And the chapter majors, as does the rest of the book of Genesis, upon one particular descendant of Jacob, one particular son. That person is Joseph, Jacob's son by Rachel, born in Paddan Aram. And why is Joseph so important? Well, it was during Joseph's life that God's people developed from a mere family into a nation. And therefore, the life of Joseph is a bridge from the book of Genesis to the book of Exodus. It begins with God's people as an enlarged family, but it ends with God's people multiplying as a nation in Egypt, a people who are to be redeemed. Well, what does this chapter tell us of Joseph? We can't, of course, go into tremendous detail because the chapter's long, 36 verses. But I'll divide it into three parts in the hope of helping you to take in the teaching of the chapter. First of all, Joseph's life at Hebron, verses 1 to 11. Secondly, Joseph's journey to Dothan, verse 12 to verse 24. And thirdly, Joseph's destination in Egypt, verses 25 to 36. First of all, then, Joseph's life at Hebron. Now, at the time that this chapter begins, Jacob and his family were living near where Isaac had lived, in Hebron, which is southwest of Jerusalem. We know that from chapter 35 and verse 27. "Jacob came unto Isaac his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned." And there is other reference to Hebron in chapter 37 and verse 14. So he sent Joseph out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. So here begins the story of Joseph, with Joseph's life at Hebron. Now I want to make several points under this general head. God showed distinguishing grace to Joseph. And the means by which that grace was brought to Joseph would have included, no doubt, conversations which young Joseph would have had with Isaac, his grandfather, and with Jacob, his father. And it was through such means that grace made Joseph different from his other brethren. He was different in his heart, and he was different in his life. And the only thing that makes a person to differ from another is the grace of God, that unmerited, undeserved love of God expressed to us and making us separate. Remember the words of 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 7. Who maketh thee to differ from another? And the answer expected is God. What hast thou that thou didst not receive? Now if thou didst receive it, why dost thou glory as if thou hadst not received it? It is God in the expression of his grace to us that makes us willing in the day of his power to take him as our God. It's God in the expression of his grace which works all our works in us. And it's God in the expression of his grace that makes us to be among his people. By the grace of God, I am what I am. As the story unfolds, you will discover for yourselves that Joseph is different. And I want to begin by saying he is different because of the grace of God. And then let us say that this difference was recognized. In verse 2 of chapter 37, it says that Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. Now, the Hebrew there for feeding the flock is literally was shepherd over the flock. And the force of the Hebrew word is that he had a kind of precedency. He presided over this particular matter. And it leads commentators to believe that Joseph had a precedence here, that he was over the other sons of Jacob. He was over the sons of Bilhah and of Zilpah. He was the shepherd. And therefore he acted responsibly. And we find in verse 2 that Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now this is often suggested to be a classic case of talebearing. And Joseph is made out to be a spoiled child who is running to his father and telling secrets and getting his other brothers into trouble. But I think the truth is that he was not a talebearer in that sense at all, but he was a truth bearer. And I want you to look at what is written there in verse 2 in a different light. Joseph did have a position of responsibility. He presided over his father's affairs. He had chief charge of the flock. He was head shepherd. He therefore had a responsibility for those that were under him. Secondly, he had a love for truth and for right. And he would not in any way deceive his father or give his father the false impression that all was well. He was of far greater integrity than that. Thirdly, he refused to be a partaker of other men's sins. To have kept quiet about what his brethren were doing would have been to have involved himself in their misdeeds and in their crimes. What they were doing was so serious that had he been silent, he could have been judged a conniver in these matters. And that he would not do. Fourthly, it grieved him, and it grieved his soul to see them indulging in sin. Now, we're not told what the sin was, but it was obviously serious. And he didn't treat it lightly. He couldn't smile at it or wink at it, pretend it was of no great matter. But he had a heart that was sensitive to sin in all its forms. And he was so grieved that he sought to share this with his father that their condition might be somehow remedied and that they might somehow be morally restored. Fifthly, it seems that he had himself no power to reform them. He was over them. And therefore he did have authority. But we must assume that authority has been exercised to no real account, to no profit. And it was only therefore as a last resort that he turns to his father. Sixthly, the actions of these brethren were shameful. When it says, he brought unto his father their evil report, that either means that he reported what he observed in their conduct, or he told his father the rumor that was circulating, the report of these men, which was in every place, and what they were doing. If it's the latter, my friends, the whole family name was being brought into discredit and into disrepute. I believe, lastly, that Joseph was deeply troubled over what the consequences might be for his brethren if they went on unrebuked, and if they went on, as it were, unhindered in their way, where might it lead them? And therefore, it was out of a concern for God's glory and the good of his father's name and the souls of his brethren that he brought report unto his father. What is emerging from Joseph, you see, is this man who the grace of God has made different, and who is obviously different from his brethren, so that he can't associate with them and he can't involve himself with them. in their manner of life. The grace which has worked in him has worked upon him. And he is different in soul and he's different in conduct. Then also observe that it was this kind of holiness of heart and of life that endeared Joseph to Jacob. Verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children. Again, the story has often been misunderstood here. This is simply a case of favoritism or partiality. I hope to show that that is not a just or right understanding of what we have here. The reason why Jacob loved Joseph, particularly in verse 3, is given because he was the son of his old age. Now that could mean that he was particularly loving of Joseph because Joseph was born when Jacob was old. In fact, Joseph was born in Jacob's 91st year. But it's difficult to understand it like that because another son, Zebulun, was the same age as Joseph. And why wasn't he loved like this? And in fact, there was a younger son, Benjamin. So how come that Joseph is described as the son of his old age? Well, we need to go back to the original Hebrew, and the literal rendering of the Hebrew is this: a son of old age was he to Jacob. A son of old age was he to Jacob. And just by that literal rendering, it suggests another view of these words. It suggests perhaps that Joseph possessed the wisdom of advanced years, that he was more knowledgeable and understanding than any of the others, that he was able to communicate with his father as one on his own level, particularly, no doubt, about the things of God. A son of old age. In other words, he was so mature. He was a son of old age to Joseph, to Jacob. He had a mature head on his shoulders, as we say. And he was able to converse with Jacob almost as an advisor, as a counselor. Because, of course, they had the grace of God in common and holiness of life in common. And therefore, they were able to share things. And for this reason, among others, Jacob had a particular love for him. Of course, you could add to that. He loved him because he was so like his God. He loved him because he was a God-fearing, God-obeying man. He loved him because he was spiritual and holy. Israel loved Joseph more than all his children. Now he was given, in consequence, a coat of many colours, Verse 3, and he made him a coat of many colours. Well, you know, learned treatises have been written about this coat of many colours. What did it signify? Well, there are those who say that it was a mark of distinction. It distinguished him from his brethren. And it showed that Jacob recognized in him a gracious and a godly man who was as his equal, who was more a brother than a son to him. Now, in the second book of Samuel, chapter 13 and verse 18, we read of one that she had a garment of divers colours upon her, for with such robes were the king's daughters that were virgins apparelled. The same word in the original. She had a garment of divers colours upon her. And in this case, it distinguished her from others. And maybe it was a mark of distinction. But others say, no, it was more than that. It showed that Joseph was actually superior to his brethren. Because such a garment would have been worn by a ruler. And so we read in Judges 5 and verse 30 how that to Sisera a prey or plunder of divers colours, a prey of divers colours of needlework, of divers colours of needlework on both sides, meet for the necks of them that take the spoil. In other words, a garment suitable to a lord or to a king. In which case the coat of many colours would have not just marked Joseph out as different, but it would have marked him out as a chief or a head to whom responsibility had been entrusted and authority. But there is a third view. And there is the third view is that the reference might be to a priestly garment. Now, it is clear from elsewhere in the Old Testament that although Reuben was the firstborn and would have had the rights of the firstborn, yet he was rejected. If you look at 1 Chronicles 5, 1 and 2, it speaks of the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but forasmuch as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, and the genealogy is not to be reckoned after his birthright. For Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler. But the birthright was Joseph's. Now, in the birthright blessing of the Old Testament was included, as we've seen earlier in our studies, the office of priest. The one who had the birthright officiated for the family in the father's absence. And he would have acted the part of priest. He would have offered the sacrifice. He would have made the prayers. He would have brought the praise of the family to God. Now this word, coat of many colours, could refer therefore to the priest's clothing, such as is mentioned in chapter 28. of Exodus and verse 4, the holy garments for Aaron. The holy garments. And these garments were highly colored. And we know that they were of different colors. And when the priest wore his garment, he looked most attractive and most beautiful. Well, if that's the case, and I'm not dogmatizing on it at all, but if it's the case that Reuben was rejected, that Joseph inherited the birthright, including the sacerdotal ministry or the priestly ministry, then this shows that this man had dealings with God. He was in the habit of communing with God. He enjoyed fellowship with God. He was often in the presence of God, conversing with God, and sharing the things of life with God. He was a man of God. Next we read that his brethren hated him. Verse 4, and when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. Now, why did they hate him? Well, you can say the obvious answer is obvious. It was because Jacob approved him. And they were envious. Well, that is true. But surely there's more in this hatred than mere envy. It was particularly because they saw in Joseph something of the image of God, the moral image of God, holiness and righteousness. They hated him because he would not consent to be one of them. They hated him because he disapproved of their ungodly and their unholy behavior. They hated him because he would not do what his father would have condemned. They hated him because he testified against their evil practices. His brethren hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. As we proceed, we find that this man had sweet discoveries and experiences of God. Joseph dreamed a dream. In verse 9, he dreamed yet another dream. Now, these dreams were not ordinary dreams. These dreams were from God. They were divinely inspired dreams through which God communicated knowledge and information to his servant. Do you remember how later in the book of Numbers, in chapter 12 and verse 6, we read these words? Hear now my words. If there be a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known unto him in a vision and will speak unto him in a dream. Numbers 12 and verse 6. Joseph, therefore, had first-hand experience of the visitations of God. These two dreams, one concerning the sheaves which bowed down to his sheaf, and the sun and the moon, and the 11 stars, subjecting themselves to him. These dreams not only revealed the future to Joseph, but they brought encouragement to him. It's interesting that God makes this visit, and God speaks in this way to Joseph immediately after the reference to Joseph being hated by his brethren. It was as if God rallied to him in comfort and in consolation, as if God cared for him as he was under attack and under assault by those of his own household. And how often it is that God visits his people when they are in trouble and when they are misrepresented and misunderstood and when they are misjudged, and the Lord God has his own way of coming near to his people and showing himself to them and making known his word to them and pouring into their hearts his love. In this case, it was in a supernatural, miraculous way. But of course, in our own experience, it may not be supernatural or extraordinary, but it's nonetheless wonderful that God visits us and we have a living experience of him. Joseph told the brethren his dream. Verse 5, he dreamed a dream and told it to his brethren. In verse 9, he dreamed yet another dream and told it to his brethren. And he's been criticized for that. He should have kept it quiet, commentators say. It was dangerously close to a boast on his part. He was at the very least unwise and at the very worst conceited. And so Joseph comes once more under the censure of the commentators. But friends, I'm not sure that he was at fault here at all. Joseph felt that this communication was not only for himself, but he felt, because it concerned his family, it was for them too. And therefore he shared it with his family. If it was from God, and it manifestly was, and was prophetic, and was confirmed twice, then surely he must receive it, and they must receive it. Well, that begs the question, well, why did his father rebuke him? Verse 10, and his father rebuked him. Well, I think maybe there was in that rebuke a fear on Jacob's part that Joseph would be lifted up with pride. And perhaps Jacob felt that too bold a declaration concerning this dream would antagonize his brethren more against him. So he lovingly corrected him. But then we read in verse 11, his father observed the saying. The Hebrew is, his father kept the word. In other words, though he wondered on the wisdom of saying too much lest Joseph should be exalted and his brethren should be stirred up to greater enmity, yet he did not doubt that this was something to which he had to give an attention and something which he had to ponder. And he kept these things in his heart. It was no word of man. It was not the wild utterances of a son, over-imaginative and foolish. Jacob observed the saying in his heart. Well, my friends, what we discover here in Joseph's life at Hebron is that of a man who is peculiarly a man of God. A man who's been sanctified. A man who lives in the sphere of God's presence, who receives the word of God, a man whose life is evidently transformed when compared with the life or lives of his brethren. And we are to learn from that what manner of people we ought to be. A peculiar people, the Bible says. Zealous of good works. It is to be obvious to observers that we are the people of God. That we have no truck with wickedness. But we have a love for holiness. That we delight ourselves in God, who is our exceeding joy. That we know God in the way that the world does not know him. Jacob's life at Hebron. And secondly, and I must not be much more brief, Joseph's journey to Dothan from verse 12 through to 24. His brethren went to find pasture at Shechem, which was some 50 miles from Hebron. And we wonder why they went to Shechem, because that was the place where the atrocity had been committed just two chapters earlier, and where there had been such a slaughter committed by two of the sons of Jacob. But it says in chapter 35 that the fear of God was upon the place, and we suppose that the fear of God remained upon the place, and the people, though they had been provoked by the massacre, yet they were strangely overawed by the reality of God. And it was therefore safe for Joseph's brethren to go to Shechem. Well, Joseph was asked to go and to visit them and to see how they were. Israel, or Jacob, said to Joseph, verse 13, "Do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto him." And he said to him, "Here am I." And he said, "Go, I pray thee, and see whether it be well with thy brethren." And he sent him out of the vale of Hebron. And he came, verse 14, to Shechem. Joseph's journey, first to Shechem, but ultimately to Dothan, tells us something more of Joseph, further to what I've already said. First of all, let me observe that Jacob had only to mention this to his son. He didn't command Joseph to go. He said, "Come, and I will send thee unto them." And Joseph makes that lovely response in verse 13, "Here am I." It was a suggestion from the father. But the suggestion came to Joseph with the force of a commandment. He was willing to perform any duty, to render any service. And nonetheless remarkable for that. The second thing I notice is not only this tremendous dutifulness in Joseph, but the fact that he goes to cheer his brethren with a voice from home. And it was very magnanimous of him to do that. "I will send thee to see whether it be well with thy brethren. The very words, perhaps, thy brethren, might have brought a cold feeling to Joseph's heart. Those that hate me. But it's to find out how they are. It's to find out if there's need. It's to find out if they're well. And Joseph, despite the way he's been treated, clearly has a forgiving spirit. And he's prepared to go to these other sons of Jacob. I think that is remarkable. We don't know how much Jacob knew of his son's hatred for Joseph. That's not revealed in the chapter. But one thing is sure, Joseph knew how much they hated him. And yet he was prepared to forgive them. Now I say thirdly, he was more than prepared to forgive, he was prepared to go and do good to them. As if he was overcoming evil, as Paul says, with good. He was prepared to go and inquire after their welfare, and doubtless if they'd said, we have a pressing need upon us, he would have done whatever he could, even if it meant returning to his father to relay the news of that need. He would do everything he could to meet the needs of his brethren. What a man this is! A man who's ready to perform a service. A man who is gracious and merciful and forgiving in spirit. And a man who's prepared to do good to those that have only done evil to him. Perhaps, friends, Joseph thought, fourthly, that his going and his inquiry and the expression of his concern would help to melt their hearts. He wanted reconciliation. Fifthly, I think it shows that Joseph was known to be reliable. All Jacob could have faith in him that he would go and he would bring back a faithful report. In other words, he emerges here as somebody who's dependable and trustworthy. Sixthly, it's a long journey. Some 60-odd miles, 50 to 60 miles to Shechem. And yet he wouldn't be deterred by the length of the journey or by the risks and dangers he might encounter on the journey. Such was his respect for his father and his concern for his brethren. And lastly, let me observe that he persevered even to Dothan, because when he got to Shechem, they weren't there. Do you remember he inquired of that man? And the man said, no, they've moved on. I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And verse 17, Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. 20 miles further on. So that this man covered at least 70 miles. Out of deference to his father's will and his brethren's good. That's the kind of man he was. If you like, it was faith evidenced in works. I believe we too should be careful to make manifest the grace of God in a consistent life of holiness. How consistent Joseph appears in all this. I would only observe that whilst you have Joseph active for God, you have at the same time God active for Joseph. There's a tremendous providence here. The inworkings and outworkings of divine providence. God had made it clear to Joseph that he would one day be exalted. That his parents and his brethren would acknowledge him to be a Lord. And as this man was active for God, God was active for him. When he got to Shechem, the brethren went there. They'd moved on to Dothan. Now the purpose of God was that ultimately Joseph must go down to Egypt. That's where he's going to be Lord. That's where he's going to have influence. That's where he's going to save his people. That's where he's going to receive the acknowledgments of a vast family, Egypt. Had he met his brethren in Shechem, Jacob had a plot of land in Shechem. He was kind of proprietor there, and he would have had friends there, no doubt, and associates. Word might have got back to Jacob of what these brethren were about to do to Joseph, and the whole thing might have been prevented. He might not have been taken down to Egypt at all. The providence of God orders that the brethren pass on to Dothan. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, the significance of that is that Dothan is a trade route from Syria to the Nile Valley. So if Joseph is going to go to Egypt, which is what God intends, he's no good in being in Shechem. He must be in Dothan, where the road leads straight into the heart of Egypt. All the providence of God. We know that when his brethren saw him, the first reaction was that they would kill him. The providence of God, he must not be killed. Why? Because he's going to be a lord in Egypt. And the dream is going to be realized and fulfilled. And his brethren are one day going to come before him and bow to him and do obeisance to him. He will not be killed. You can almost hear God say it. And the second thought was, well, we'll throw him into this pit or into this well and leave him to starve. But the God of providence says, no. He must not be left to starve, because my purpose will not be realized if he's left to starve. He will never be a lord and a sovereign, and his family will never come to bow themselves before him. So one of the brothers comes up with the idea, let's sell him to this company of Ishmaelites, which came from Gilead bearing spicery and balm and myrrh in order to carry it down to Egypt. Why don't we sell him to them? And the providence of God says, yes, that's what you'll do. Because he's got to go to Egypt. And he's got to be raised to be second only to Pharaoh in Egypt. And he's got to assume such sovereignty that you'll bow before him, that my word may be fulfilled and my vision might be realized. That's what you'll do. And it's at that very time, in the providence of God, that this company of Ishmaelites or Midianites happens to pass by. And they sell him for 20 pieces of silver. And he's on his way. Friends, the lesson is this. If, as a believer, you are active for God, God is active for you. If you perform what is right before him, he will perform what is right before you. You do his service and he will do you service. You work for him, he'll work for you. You fulfill his will, he'll fulfill his will concerning you. And what a blessed thing it is to be living the believer's life and knowing that God is guiding you with his eye. Which brings me to this last point. Joseph's destination in Egypt. We've got Joseph's life at Hebron, his journey to Dothan, and his destination in Egypt from 25, really to the end of the chapter. The end of verse 28, they brought Joseph to Egypt. Now, I'm not going to dwell upon the malice and cruelty and hard-heartedness of the brethren. I'm not going to dwell on the grief and the distress and the despair of Jacob when he thought that his son had perished. But I am going to dwell on the fact that Joseph arrived at the appointed destination. He was brought to Egypt. God had said to Abraham that his people would be for years in the land of bondage. And there they would be redeemed and brought out. It was necessary for Joseph to go down to Egypt, for his family there to grow, and ultimately to come under tyranny, and finally to be redeemed. God was working his purpose out. Friends, the most comforting truth I know is that when we are the Lord's, and when we are doing him service, God is working his purpose out in our lives. We may not always be aware of it, we may not always appreciate it, but God is fulfilling his plan. And just as Joseph's destination was in Egypt, there was a glorious future for him and for his family in Egypt. God fulfills his plan, and it's always good and perfect and acceptable. It always leads somehow to blessing, to mercy and to goodness. He knows the way that I take. He shall guide me with his counsel. He leadeth me. That was Joseph's experience, and may it be ours. For Christ's sake. Amen.